Yes, Dr. Davidson?
Here.
Dr. Davy is absent. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Here.
Mr. Chair, you have a quorum.
Excellent. Item number 3 is called to the public. Those wishing to address the committee do not need to request permission in advance. However, the committee may limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number of public comments matters. In addition, each person wishing to address the committee will be given 5 minutes to do so. The committee can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Is there anybody in the room or on the line who wishes to address the committee at this point?
No, there is not.
Okay. And item number 4, approval of the January 6th, 2020 regular session minutes. May I have a motion to approve?
Mr. Chairman, I need to make or suggest some corrections. Do we, is this the time that I would speak about that?
Yes.
That would be in the discussion, I believe.
Okay.
Right? So we have a motion and a second?
Well, but I believe...
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, she went ahead and made a motion, so if there's a second, then Dr. Stenhoff could make his corrections.
That's what I thought. Okay. So I'm sorry, did I hear a second?
Mr. Chairman, sorry, who made the original motion? That was me,
Dr.
Paige?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry, it must have cut out. I just didn't hear it. Sorry.
So I jumped in when perhaps I shouldn't have. I answered that question and I said Dr. Stenhoff made the motion, and I think I was incorrect.
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was Dr. Rates who made the motion.
Okay.
And since I'm on here, I'll make a second.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for item number 4, regarding the applicants, I just need to note a slight change in the wording in the minutes. For applicants number 3, 6, 7, and 8, I need to request a change from is a student to was a student. So moving from present to past tense.
Okay, I think those have been noted. Are there any other changes?
That is all I have.
Okay, so would the doctors who made the motion and the second accept those changes?
Yes.
Okay, then you can call for the question.
Are there any further changes, any other discussion about the matter? Hearing none, all in favor to approve these minutes with the changes, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
This is Kathy in the board's office. Who just joined the call?
Yes, this is Kathy.
Oh, thank you. Chairman Davidson, Ms. Roth-Lutner is on our line now with us.
Excellent. Welcome. We're just finishing up some other items, and we will get to your agenda item in a little while.
Okay, thank you.
The next item is the January 6, 2020 executive session minutes. Can I have a motion to approve these minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion to approve.
Thank you.
I'll second.
All right. Any further discussion?
I'm sorry, the second, was that Dr. Rates or Dr. Davis Wilson?
Davis Wilson.
Okay, thank you.
All Okay, so we have a motion and a second. No further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Okay, the next item on the agenda is item number 5, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations to the board pertaining to approval of behavior analyst applicants. In light of the fact that Ms. Rutner has joined us the call, would it be okay with everyone if we revised, rearranged, and put her application first?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I have no objection.
Okay, wonderful. So, that's me.
And Mr. Chairman, I do need to interject, disclose that I was Ms. Ross Ludner's instructor while she was a student, but I feel that I'm able to consider the application without bias.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I do need to disclose that I actually have done a lot of work with Ms. Brennan Dolo, I don't even know if they're last name, that's how big I am. But I just wanted to make it known that while we have had professional correspondence in the past, and we'll likely have professional correspondence in the future, it is on a professional basis, and I do not see the bias within there.
Okay. Thank you both. This point of clarification, we have, and this Ruffner's application that we will be revisiting in light of information from her supervisor. We will be dealing with her supervisor, addressing a supervisor at a later point in this meeting agenda. But also for the record disclosure, I was the supervisor's instructor many years ago, but I believe I can be objective without bias or prejudice in this matter. So, Ms. Rockwood's application. As you know, we had approved her application back on January 6th, and then later learned from her that there might have been an error in her application, and that one of her supervisors may not have been licensed for a portion of the time that she supervised Ms. Lutner, specifically for a two-month period between August of 18 and October of 18, and Ms. Rothrudner notified us of that. She also submitted in her information that additional hours that she was in fact supervised by Christine Herrera, supervisor licensed in Arizona, for an additional 567 hours, which would be more than enough hours to cover the hours that may not count if in fact her supervisor was not licensed during that time period. Do I have that correct so far?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Kathy in the board's office. Board staff has confirmed that Ms. Ndolo was not licensed from September 1st, 2018 to October 29th, 2018.
That is true, and thank you for that. Okay. So, there was additional communication between board staff drop witness, asking when she learned of her supervisor, Ms. Madolo, not being licensed for that period of time. And she responded, after I listed her as a supervisor in my application. She went on to say, I became worried when the application was approved because I didn't know what documents were sent and by whom. Board staff, what was the rationale behind asking for that information?
This is Jean Galvin, and I had met with staff on this issue, and it did come to our attention. We recognized that the applicant did notify the board that her supervisor was unlicensed for a period of time during which she received supervision. She notified the board after her license, the recommendation was made that her license be granted. I directed staff to ask the applicant when she learned of that. I wanted to know if she submitted her application knowing that the supervisor was unlicensed for a period of time. In response to that question, she says that she learned of the supervisor not being licensed after she listed her as a supervisor. So I don't know if that's before she submitted her application to the board or after she submitted her application to the board. If she learned that after she listed her, if the applicant could tell me when and exactly did you learn that your supervisor was unlicensed for that period of time?
Thank you for that clarification. Ms. Ruffler, can you respond?
Yeah, so I tried to contact Ms. Nodalo to send out my supervised experience form. I've been trying to contact her since, I believe, maybe September. So I already had my application filled out. Then I sent my application, and she contacted me, I believe, for the end of November or December, and we've been back and forth in emails, and finally she said she would submit my form, but that she wasn't licensed, and I told her, well, I still need the remaining hours, so she submitted the form, at least she said she would, but at the same time, I contacted one of my professors, and I told him the situation. I sent that professor about three emails, and then my current supervisor sent them follow emails as well. So when my application got approved, I didn't know if maybe my professor also signed up on hours or if she submitted documentation. And if she did, I just wanted to make sure what documentation she sent. And that's why I contacted you guys and asked you, like, what documentation was sent, by whom, and what time period.
So you didn't know if Ms. Nandola had submitted a supervisory form for you?
She said she would, but in the past she said she would do things and never followed through. Like, I have to be on her back about things sometimes. So I didn't know if it was her or my professor who submitted form.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. So it appears as though you had, between your various supervisors, you had more than enough hours to meet the $1,500 requirement. You asked multiple supervisors to submit their hours on your behalf, but you didn't know exactly how many hours were going to be submitted and by whom at this point?
I do have more than enough hours. The reason I didn't submit my current supervisor's hours in the very beginning is because I didn't think I would need them. And I also contacted my professor and seen if he could sign off between the time period where Ms. Nadolo wasn't licensed.
Okay. So I, Ms. Rothlutner, sorry, Ms. Rothlutner, this is Jean Galvin, the board's attorney again. I'm a little confused on the timing. Previously, you said you had asked Ms. Nandola, your current supervisor, your current professor, to submit hours in the beginning.
Because, yeah.
Okay, but now you just said you went back to your current supervisor to submit the hours now. You didn't ask her previously because you thought you wouldn't need them. Now you just said you had to go back, ask her to submit the supervisory hours to fill in the gap where Nandola was not licensed. So I'm confused.
Oh, sorry for the confusion. No, in the very beginning, I only asked Ms. Nadolo, my professor, to cover the hours where there was a gap, and I asked Emily Davis and Michelle Reed, and then after I talked to you guys, and I didn't hear back from my professor, and you guys requested more hours, then I talked to my current supervisor, and I had more than enough hours with her, and that's why she submitted.
But you did ask another supervisor to submit hours to cover the hours that where there was a gap with Nandola before your application was approved. Is that what you're telling us?
I did ask, yes.
So you knew that there was an issue with Nandola while your application was pending, is that right?
Yes, and then it got all of a sudden approved, and that's why I was concerned, because I didn't know who submitted which document.
So you knew there was an issue with Nandola's hours while your application was pending, and you didn't notify the board?
No, because I didn't know whether or not she was going to submit or who submitted which document. It just got approved, and then that's why I grew concerned, because I had no way of knowing which documents were submitted.
And this is Kathy in the board's office. Just to be clear for the committee to be aware, in the process of the administrative review, staff does not tell the applicant what documents were received. We tell them what we haven't received based on what they put on their application. So Ms. Rothlutner would not know specifically from me what was received and from who. She'd only know it if the supervisor informed her directly that they sent it in.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is Kathy again. Can I ask Ms. Rothlutner a question? Ms. Rothlutner, did you have an expectation that either the board would note that Nandola did not have a license for 2 months or that Nandola was going to tell us?
I had the expectation that Nandola would not submit the hour because, like I previously said, in the past, there's a history where she would tell me she would do something and she doesn't follow through. And I also had the expectation that you guys would find out as well.
So you suspected then that she would submit the hours because you're saying you expected the board to find out she was unlicensed for that period of time.
I'm saying that even though she told me through email that she would submit the hours, I didn't expect her to submit the hours, and that's why I was talking to my professor. And I knew if she were to, you guys would either attach it or I would say something. That's why I came forth and asked which documents were submitted.
Only after your application was approved and your license was recommended to be issued. Is that correct?
Yes, because it was approved in like, I believe maybe a few days later, and then the license was approved. It was a really quick process, and I didn't want to misrepresent myself. I wanted to make sure that everything was in order, all the documents.
So is the main concern here that Ms. Ruff-Lutner might have known that there was something wrong with the hours and she did not notify the board of that?
This is Jean Galvin. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, please, go right ahead.
It just seems as though, and based on what she's telling us, she had suspected that the hours submitted may not have been appropriate because of the lapse in licensure, and she did not notify the board until after it was voted and recommended to grant her license. The timeline is very confusing as to which supervisor she asked for hours, when she knew there was a gap.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, if I may, I think in obviously reading it and hearing the conversation, I think that this goes back to my concerns about the exemption of licensure in the school setting. Because I think that where this becomes confusing, and we've seen this before, and our course of action has been to request additional supervised hours to be documented, is that there's this perception that the BCBAs in the school system are exempt from licensure. And so I think that what happens is that people don't understand the effects that has been on supervision. And so when you have an individual that is operating the school where there's an exemption that says, hey, the school setting, if otherwise, I mean, we can contest how I read that, because you guys all know my opinion on how I read that exemption. But if we've seen this before, where individuals go through, they get supervised, and they are under the impression, both the supervisor and the supervisee, that exemption covers them. And so the supervisors are oftentimes saying, well, I'm exempt from, or it wasn't a big deal because I work in the schools. And I'm not sure that any of this conversation has been had. I'm just saying historically, we've seen applicants come forth with the same thing. And the way that we address it is we say, well, sorry, we can't approve your license unless you can prove to us that you have these additional hours. Now, I think that with two things, I do think that many of the organizations kind of carry the applicant through a continued supervised program beyond the 1,500 hours out of fear of inadequately supervising. And so I think that if we would have caught this in January, our request would have been to do, you know, a request for information to be able to say, hey, we need additional hours. And it looks like those hours are continuously or were continuously being provided. And so for me, I understand where like the confusion of the timeline may lie, but I also know that we've got a little bit of that language that it has historically been confusing to both applicants and to supervisors. And I think that the supervision provided above and beyond is even greater than the number of hours that are even in question. I understand, especially Ms. Galvin, where it's like, well, the timeline seems funny. But I also want to note that the fact that the applicant so quickly came out was like, well, wait a second. Now that all this information is available, I do have some concerns. I wish that there was a better way that maybe the folks, it's a different discussion where they would have an idea of what's being submitted and where. And it's not that all of the hours of the supervisor are being contested, it's just a portion of the hours. And so I think for me, I'm looking at it from a little bit of a different perspective. If it were all of the hours and we're trying to push through 1,000 hours that should have been a red flag, then that's one thing, but it's a small amount and it does look like the supervision continued beyond the 1,500 hours. And so I think from a perspective of precedence, this has been the exact documentation we would have requested from an applicant.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. I also want to note, we received Ms. Rothlutner's application on December 20th. It was administratively complete. A week later, on 12/28, I sent her the admin complete notice. And then it went to CBA on January 6th. It was very, very fast for an application. And and I would also like to, and maybe we'll talk about this later on the Andolo matter, but we've historically been using the online website for proof of licensure in Arizona, and clearly this has demonstrated that that's not adequate. And so I just wanted to make that point as well. It did not come up in our normal pattern of verifying licensure.
Yeah, and I hear that, and I appreciate that you documented that too, and I know that. I too want to mention, and I agree with Dr. Davis Wilson, that it was the applicant herself who quickly notified the board shortly after receiving confirmation that her application was approved. And I think that says something. And the fact that she could not and didn't think that she would get a response from her supervisor in a timely manner, but she tried to get an answer to her question. I mean, I can understand how all of that could happen in short order while the application moved quickly forward. Is it possible to, in terms of our options, can we add the additional 567 hours from another supervisor to her application for our records, and include a comment about quickly notifying the board for any future issues concerning your licensure? Something to that effect?
My recommendation would be, because you previously made a recommendation to approve her application, that went to the board. The board accepted that recommendation and approved her application. We now know that she was ineligible for that license based on the lack of hours. So she has submitted additional hours. What I would prefer that you do is rescind your previous motion recommending licensure, and then once that is complete, review the application, accept these new hours, and make a new recommendation because of the submission of additional hours.
So, Mr. Chair, Ms. Galvin, would that involve then rescind full board next week, application review in March, and then that would kind of be our timeline at that point? Or can we rescind and then take action now, or can we rescind and make an option to maybe just move it to the full board for application review?
No, I would go ahead, rescind now, and review the application with the new hours and make a new recommendation, and it'll go to the board next week.
Perfect. Okay. Mr. Chair, I motion to rescind our approval on the January 10th application, our recommendation on January 6th to approve her application.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
I will second.
So is that Dr. Reid?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So we have a motion and a second to rescind her previous application. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Opposed? Motion carried. Now, can
Mr.
we
Chair,
entertain? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to go right forward with the motion for you to go ahead and approve the application based on the additional submission of the hours that were provided by Ms. Herrera. I motion to move forward with recommending this application to the full board.
Okay. Do I have a second?
I second.
We have a motion and a second to approve Ms. Rothman's application and move it forward to the full board for approval. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, Ms. Rothman. Do you understand what just happened?
Yes, I do. Thank you so much.
So your application still needs to be reviewed by the full board again, but that will happen soon.
Yes, I understand. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your time. And Ms. Galvin, thank you for your help on this.
You're welcome.
Mr. Chair, can we just, for clarification purposes, because the applicant, it has been a month, so to clarify, the individual is currently not licensed. And so I just want to make sure that that is clear. And then on the next, once we get that approved, then we can move forward. But I definitely would hate to see the applicant provide independent services, not understanding that process. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you. That's an excellent point and worth clarification. Okay. Moving on to our next applicant. That would be Amy Shank.
Mr. Chair, I am recused from this applicant.
Okay. We still have a quorum with three other committee members.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I also want to disclose that I was her director at an agency that we were both employed, but I'm able to consider this application without bias.
Okay. Thank you both. Okay. Ms. Shank, graduated from ASU, Curriculum Instruction Department, with a Master's in Education in August of 2019. She received 1,500 hours of supervision while under the supervisor Mako Elke, who is licensed in Arizona at that time, working for Hope Group. She was board certified in November of 2019. I did not note any concerns with this application, and I would recommend that it be forwarded to the board for approval. Other committee members, concerns or questions? Okay, hearing none. Let us move on to the next applicant, which is Brandy Stufik. This would be Dr. Davis Wilson, and I need to disclose that I worked with Ms. Stufik briefly and supervised her briefly during that time period, but I believe I can be objective and without prejudice or bias in reviewing this application.
Dr. Davidson, when you said you go ahead. Did you verify any hours? Okay. Were you involved in the supervision for this application?
I did. I verified 160 hours.
Okay, I would recommend that you recuse.
Okay.
That just because that's a fairly close relationship.
Okay, I'm fine with that. I thought that in the past we had had committee members who were also supervisory or shared supervisory role. But I'm fine with that. That leaves us without a quorum on her application.
No, I think we're okay. I think you're okay because Dr. Davis-Wilson is not recusing, and neither is Dr. Stenhoff or Dr. Rates.
Oh, great. Hey, just my math skills that work again.
I feel you.
Okay, and then I will complete the recusal form and submit that.
Thank you.
Perfect, and I will act as chair since I am on the case anyway, reviewing the application anyway. So Ms. Dufik passed her exam in August of 2019. She's applying for initial licensure. She completed a Master's of Education in Positive Behavior Support from Northern Arizona University. She finished that in May of 2017. She did submit a little bit over 1,500 hours of supervision from the periods of September 2015 through December 2018. On her application, she did answer yes to number 12 and number 13, and she did provide additional documentation. And the documentation that she provided for number 12, which is pertaining to having been charged with or currently under review of any criminal activity. She did disclose that she was arrested in November of 2015 for a disorderly conduct charge. In the documentation, it is also listed that assault was the primary charge on a case. An incident involving family members at a bar where some conflict arose with the bouncer. It appears that according to the police report, both Ms. Dufik and her sister were accused of punching the bouncer multiple times. She did go through court, and they did an agreement to dismiss the case pending anger management classes, and she did provide us that documentation. As it pertains to question number 13, she states that she was sued by a previous employer in 2018. The original claim that was filed was pertinent to concerns of fraudulent activity, billing above and beyond authorized hours. There was also some additional concerns related to documentation and therapy notes as it pertained to the services being provided. It appears that the claim was resolved, and that although there were concerns of additional claims being filed, it looks like the attorney has noted that no further claims had been provided. And so we can talk about that in just a minute. I also would like to note for her application on page 10, her supervisor, Karen Belize, answered no to number four, stating that she did not observe the applicant conducting behavior analytic services. So that concludes my review of the application. I would like to open it up for discussion Does any of the board members have any discussion or questions at this point? I have a couple. My first point to note is that regarding number 12, I did have a little bit of a concern that, and it could have been how it played out in as far as the charging process went, but that Ms. Dufick just alluded to the disorderly conduct, did not mention the assault, stated that the disorderly conduct was a matter of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, being, you know, her sister was pushed over by a bouncer, she fell over, it was just chaos, that did not align with the police report or the witness statements that stated that there was video of Ms. Dufick taking punches at the bouncer, so I do have a little bit of concerns with the conflicting story. And it, with regard to number 13, I do note that we were provided the 1099 contract. It does not look like she was employed by the agency, but rather a 1099 contract. And the contract does specifically state that the coverage of services was for direct therapy sessions, yet there were multiple extensive amounts of material set up and non-billable, non-payable work being conducted while the students were out sick. And so I did have some concerns around that. I do have some concerns that the contract did call for SLPA services. SLPA services aren't generally trained in the functional behavior assessment process. And while it's possible that she was receiving supervision from an outside supervisor during that time, I did not see any documentation to show that that functional behavior assessment was supervised by the appropriate provider. And I'm still, although I'm making the assumption that the first claim was resolved, I'm still not clear how that was resolved. I don't know if the agency just stopped pursuing it. Or nonetheless, I have a lot of questions, and unfortunately, the applicant is not here to kind of address the questions that I have. We can have a discussion about it, but I think for me personally, I really do think that we need to request that the applicant be present so that we can get our concerns resolved. I also think we need clarification in a request for information regarding the supervisor stating that she did not observe the behavior analytic work.
This is Dr. Reeves, and I agree. I think, to your point, another concern I had is her sort of statement related to the second issue with the school district also seemed to leave out some important information, things that you stated related to billing, documentation of service. So I was a bit concerned, as you noted in the first issue, that the response doesn't seem to fully match all of the documentation we received. So I would agree, I think we need some more information and to be able to answer some of those questions.
Does the committee want the applicant to appear personally and answer questions?
I think that would be better. I don't know that we can craft a request for information that would allow for us to feel confident in the responses given the information we have thus far. I would rather the individual appear in person, yes. And I don't know if that needs to be motioned now or if it can be subbed with the full motion.
No, I would prefer a motion. I'm just thinking at what future meeting. Is there a meeting where the majority of the committee would be present in person, or do you want her to appear on the phone? Just so staff
I
can...
would be... be okay with it being on the phone. I do think that it's nice to have one or two in-person committee meetings, but I know that that is kind of difficult to get scheduled, and there's a lot of stuff. So I would be okay with the individual being on the phone if board staff feel that that's probably, like I said, getting a room and getting, you know, the committee together and getting a quorum. Like, it may at this time just be best to have the individual appear by phone.
Yeah, and the only reason I asked is so the staff could be clear in their communication with her.
Perfect. Then I would make a motion that at this point we have board staff contact her and request that she appear by phone at an upcoming committee meeting so that we can get our questions answered. I'll second. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion carries. And Dr. Davidson, I will hand that back over to you.
And I will figure out how to kick myself off of you. Okay, the next applicant we have is Charissa Devlin. Dr. Davis Wilson, that's you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Charissa Devlin completed her exam in November. She actually did her master's of ADA through the online program at Arizona State University, which she completed in August of 2018. Between the periods of October of 2017 and April of 2018, she completed 1,500 hours of supervised field experience under multiple supervisors who are all licensed in the state of Arizona. At this time, I have no concerns with her application, and I would recommend it to move forward to the school board.
Thank you. Other committee members, any questions or concerns about this application? Hearing none, then we move on to the next application for Christina Faust, Dr. Reed.
Yes, I would like to disclose that this individual works at the same agency as I do. That said, we have not interacted in any way, so I feel comfortable moving forward with the review without bias. So Ms. Faust received her BCBA in November of 2019. She completed her master's as well in 2019 from the University of West Florida. She received supervision at the Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center under Christine Gomez between September of 16 and June of 19 for a total of 2,151 hours. In reviewing the application, I did not see any areas of concern and would recommend that we move that forward.
Other committee members, questions or concerns? Hearing none. Our next application is for Eric Hill. Dr. Stenup.
Mr. Harris graduated and received a master's degree from Grand Canyon University in November of 2011. He completed a postgraduate certificate in applied behavior analysis at the University of California, Los Angeles in June of 2017. He received 1,500 hours of supervision under Christina Bartel and Aaron Juarez. And I do not know any concerns with this application.
Thank you. Any other questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. The next application we have is for Holland Thompson. And that would be you, Dr. Davis.
And Mr. Chair. Oh,
sorry, this is Dr. Race again. I just want to indicate that this individual does work at the same agency as I do.
again, I have not had any interactions, so I feel comfortable in reviewing without bias.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Thompson is applying for initial licensure. She passed her exam in November of 2019. She also graduated in 2019 from ASU's Master's of ABA online program. She completed a total of 1,500 hours for the period of April 2018 to September of 2019. And at this time, I have no concerns with her application and recommend it to be moved forward to school board.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. The next application is for Jennifer Santorima. Ms. Santorima,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Sorry,
Mr.
Chair, I'm recused from this matter. I'm recused from this matter.
Dr. Davis Wilson, that's you.
Correct.
I think she's just
going to. Okay, and Dr. Stella?
Yeah, I just wanted to disclose that I've worked with her as a consultant and consult to an agency for whom she works, but I believe I'm able to consider the application without bias.
Okay, thank you.
So there's just one recusal?
There's one recusal.
Okay,
there's one disclosure.
Okay, very good.
And there's another disclosure coming from me. She took coursework at NAU, coursework that I oversaw several years ago. I don't remember anything about the student tech, fortunately, it was a long time ago. I believe I can be objective without bias or prejudice. One recusal. So she received her master's in special education with an emphasis on the positive behavior support ABA certificate from the fall of 2011 to fall of 2014. She received 1,556 hours of supervised experience from VISTA Center, the supervisor at Laura Milstein, who was licensed at the time. I did not see any concerns with this application, and I would recommend that it be forwarded to the board for approval. Concerns or questions from other committee members? Hearing none. The next application is for June Martin. Dr. Lee?
Yes. So Julie received her BCBA in October of 2010. She also holds a license in Arizona as an SLP. She received her master's from Northern Illinois University in speech and language, and then additionally received a certificate in ABA from the Florida Institute of Technology. She obtained her supervision between June of 2009 and July of 2010 under Laura O'Rourke for a total of 1,500 hours. That did occur in the state of Illinois, but licensure was not in place. In reviewing the application, I didn't have any areas of concern and would recommend that we move this forward.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. Our next application is from Kathy Sackel.
Ms. Sacco earned a Master's of Science in Applied Behavior Analysis from the Chicago School of Professional Psychology's online program in August of 2019. She received about 1,510 hours of supervision under Emily Mariner, and I did not know any concerns with this application.
Thank you. Questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. The next application is for Kelsey Anderson. I need to disclose that Kelsey Anderson and I work for the same organization for a brief period of time. We have very little interaction with each other. I can believe us to be objective without bias or prejudice in this chat. Ms. Anderson completed her master's in science and education from Sage Colleges from January 2017 to December 2018. She obtained over 1,700 hours of supervised experience from human development under supervisor Jamie Burden, who was licensed at that time. She received her BCBA in November of 2019. I did not note any concerns with this application, and I would recommend it be forwarded to the board for approval. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. Our next application is for Kristen Murphy. Dr. Rates?
Yes. So Ms. Murphy received her BCBA in November of 2019. She completed her master's in education in 2017 through ASU. She obtained supervision at Hope Group between September 17 and April of 2019 for a total of 1,500 hours, and this was under Tisha Denton. In reviewing the application, I didn't see any areas of concern.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay. Our next application is from Lauren Davis. That would be Dr. Davis Wilson.
Yes, Ms. Daly is applying for initial licensure. She passed her exam in November of 2019. She graduated from the University of Arizona Masters of Arts in Behavior Support, and that was in 2016. From October 2017 to April 2018, she completed 1,500 supervised hours in Arizona under a licensed behavior analyst. And at this time, I have no concerns with her application and would recommend it to move forward to the board.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other community members? Hearing none, our next applicant, next application is from Liam Haggerty. Dr. Wade.
Yes, so Liam received his BCBA in November of 2019. He completed a master's from Capella University in July of 2018. In addition, he received the certification in ABA, or certificate in ABA, also from Capella University in 2019. He completed all of his supervision at CARD across multiple supervisors, and I'd like to thank the board for reaching out to get the dates and locations for all of that supervision. And looking at the supervision, he did have a total of 1,500 hours across those multiple supervisors, and that supervision occurred across multiple states. And looking at everything, I didn't see concerns. The dates and supervisors all lined up. So again, thank you to board staff for that, and would recommend we move forward.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? All right. Hearing none. Next application is from Megan Blumke. Dr. Stone. Are you muted, Dr. Stone?
Yes, I am. Thank you. So she earned a Master of Arts degree in special ed and with behavior support from University of Arizona in December of 2018. Received about 1,900 hours of supervision under Lindsay Abbott and Casey Ruth, and I didn't note any concerns, and I didn't know if there was any questions or concerns from other committee members on this.
I don't hear any. So thank you.
Yeah.
Our next application is from Nicole Rogers. Ms. Rogers earned her master's in science and ABA from St. Cloud State University in June of 2019. She has over 1,500 hours of supervised experience from two different supervisors in two different settings, one in Arizona, being SARC, and one in Minnesota. The supervisor in Arizona was licensed at the time. The supervisor in Minnesota does not license behavior analyst at this time. She earned her BCBA in December of 2019, and I did not know any concerns with this application. I would recommend it be forwarded to the board for approval. Any questions or concerns from other committee members? Okay, hearing none. Our final application comes from Stephanie Miller. Dr. Stella, could you summarize?
Sure. Ms. Miller earned a Master of Education in Special Education Applied Behavior Analysis from Arizona State University in December of 2010. She accumulated about 1,600 hours of supervision under Courtney Schinbeckler. I did not note any concerns, and I'd recommend it be forwarded to the board for approval unless there are concerns or questions from other committee members.
Are there any? Hearing none, we will recommend moving her to the board. That concludes our review of behavior analyst application for licensure. So can I have a motion? Well, it looks like we have all but one are being recommended to the full board. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, this is Kathy. That's
yes,
what my
Mr.
records
Chair.
Show.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to, actually before I do that, am I able, with my recusal, am I able to make a motion?
I would prefer that you not. Is there anyone who hasn't recused?
Dr. Stenhouse.
I guess Dr. Stenhoff.
Mr. Chairman, I can.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So I make a recommendation that Ms. Shank, Devlin, Foth, Mr. Harris, Ms. Rothliner, Ms. Thompson, Ms. Santamia, I'm sorry if I butchered that. Martin, Sacco, Anderson, Murphy, Daly, Hagerty, Blumke, Rogers, Miller be move forward to the full review of the board.
Okay, we have a motion.
I will second.
We have a motion and a second. Thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We need one more motion regarding Buford.
I believe we've already motioned on that.
Oh, okay. Okay.
On six.
Then next item is item number six, discussion consideration of possible action regarding recommendation to open a complaint concerning Karina Nadolo and Ms. Hope. And let me state that Ms. Nadolo did take courses from NAU years ago. I was one of her instructors at the time. I also oversaw the courses that she took. I do believe I can be objective in this matter.
Mr. Chair, this is Dr. Davis Wilson. Now that you mentioned the coursework, I do believe that her and I did go through grad program together. However, it was an online program, so we did not have any interactions that were in person or that were in any type of personal nature. As I stated before, I do a lot of work out in the community, and so I am familiar with Nadolo and her organization, as I am with many of the organizations. However, our relationship is strictly professional, and at this point, I don't see any conflict or bias that I would have at this time.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Phelps, can you provide us with a brief summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On January 10th, 2020, after the board approved Ms. Rothlutner's application for licensure on the consent agenda, I tend to send out emails to all of the applicants on the consent agenda right away so that they don't have to wait over the weekend wondering what happened. During the board meeting, sent out an email to her to tell her that the board had approved the application. And she responded the same day to tell me that, did I receive a form from Ms. Nadolo and then informing me that she had not been licensed for 2 months during Ms. Rothlutner's supervision experience. So I looked into Ms. Ndolo's license in our database and noted that in our normal pathways that we use to verify a license, the reinstatement doesn't show, that it can only be seen when looking at the license in the database. And up to now, our processes and procedures internally were not to note anywhere that new issuance date. So that's something that staff is going to be looking into and making a change there in some way. We have to look into it and figure it out. That's another aspect of all of this that has been brought to our attention. The verification I received from Ms. Ndolo was the BACB's final experience verification form. It did not indicate a break in supervision, and Ms. Ndolo did not, in her email that she sent to us, inform us that there had been a break in her licensure during that supervision. And so basically, in sending that form, she verified that she had been supervising during those 2 months for Ms. Rothlutner. So additionally, I looked at what might have had she been properly informed that her renewal was due you know, did staff take all the proper procedures? And it indicates in the database that she did, and I've given you copies of that information. It does appear that she had failed to notify the board of a change of address, and so that when the failure to renew notices were mailed to her, they bounced back. They came back to us, returned to sender. So board staff, as she normally does, that was Krishna, sent immediately a copy of the letter by email to the email address we had on file for Ms. Indolo. So then her license expired August 31st, 2018, and we did not receive the reinstatement form until October 29th, 2018. Board statutes allow licensees to reinstate their license without having to go before the board within 2 months of expiration of the license. And Ms. Indolo barely made that deadline. And so as per the statutes and policies and procedures of our board, Krishna did reinstate the license. Ms. Indolo did provide an affidavit that was notarized with a jurat. So she swore an oath that it was all true and correct, that she had not practiced from August 31st through October 29th. And that a copy of that affidavit is included with these documents. So what is before the committee is to determine if there's a violation of statute. There are potentially a number of violations that I included on the third page of my memo, including unprofessional conduct, using fraud, misrepresentation, or deception to obtain or attempt to obtain a behavior analyst license, and violating an ethical standard adopted by the board. Additionally, the 32-2091.12 A and B, 1 and C, it is a class 2 misdemeanor for a person who is not licensed pursuant to this article to engage in the practice of behavior analysis. It is a class 2 misdemeanor for any person to secure a license to practice pursuant to this article by fraud or deceit. It is a class 2 misdemeanor for a person who is not licensed pursuant to this article to use any combination of words, initials, and symbols that leads the public to believe the person is licensed to practice behavior analysis in this state, and potentially our 4-26-413A. The board shall communicate with a licensee using the contact information provided to the board. To ensure timely communication from the board, a licensee shall notify the board in writing within 30 days of any change of name, mailing address, email address, or residential or business telephone number. And that concludes my review.
Thank you very much. That is helpful, and thank you for the memo as well. Any questions from the committee members about what we just heard?
Mr. Chair, my only question is just procedural. At this time, we're not discussing the case, but rather just determining whether or not we would like to open the complaint, given the information that we've been provided by board staff. Correct?
That's correct.
And,
I'm sorry.
If we move forward with that, we would review this at a future committee meeting?
That's correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I have a question regarding item A on the possible violation. If Ms. Nadola is engaging in behavior analytic practice in a school setting, would that align with that issue if she's doing that? Because does she need, from my understanding, as we talked and Dr. Davis Wilson mentioned this earlier, but in school settings, it's not necessary to be a licensed BCBA or licensed behavior analyst, excuse me. So would that be for, I guess it's items A and B, would that be a violation given her scope of practice and area and where she does practice?
Dr. Stenhoff.
Mr. Chair, Mr.
Go ahead.
I apologize. I was just simply going to point out that even if you were under that impression, signing an affidavit that you did not practice to me is problematic. I think that at that point, if you were concerned about the interpretation of that language, then you should have explored that prior to signing a notarized affidavit.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stenhoff, I'd like to also point out that no behavior analyst is exempt from licensure while working in a school setting, because that statute for exemption from licensure states that the behavior analyst has to be certified in some manner by the Department of Education, and the Department of Education does not provide any kind of certification for a behavior analyst.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Dr. Stenhoff, I would say that's probably my biggest concern with that specific exemption, is because we have had this overlying assumption that the services, that they would be exempt from practicing, and I think that's causing a lot of confusion in the community. When we've had applicants come forth before with that, it's been like school psychologists that provided supervision or what have you, another teacher, where they are also certified by the Department of Education. So I appreciate Ms. Fleming pointing that out, because that's been kind of an argument, longstanding argument that I've had, is that clearly says and certified by the Department of Education. So I think that's important for us to pay attention to.
Just, Mr. Chairman, committee members, a question regarding that. So certified by the Department of Ed, would that be, so are they certified as behavior analysts or just a certified individual in some capacity by the Department of Ed?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stenhoff, if I may, that language comes from the psychology practice of school psychology. And so the intent of it would be to say that master level school psychologists would not be in violation of practicing without a psychology license. That was carried over into the language for behavior analysis. The problem is that the Department of Education does not license or certify behavior analysts. They only certify teachers and school psychologists. In the exemptions, we have the exemption of if you are otherwise certified by another state entity and it's within your scope of practice, then you would be able to provide. So a school teacher who is also a behavior analyst could maybe fit into the language there, but or a school psychologist who's also a behavior analyst. But the problem that we're running into is that those individuals may then go on to provide supervision, and even though they may not, just like yourself, you know, as a university professor, you are not required to maintain licensure, but if you were to go on and provide supervision, it would hinder that person's ability to become licensed themselves. And so that's where this is getting really muddied for the community members and or for, you know, the I would say the public in general, but also the professionals, because they're not seeing how all of the different pieces fit together.
Well, thank you.
Is this discussion likely to come up in under item number 12 again?
I would venture to say yes.
Okay. So do we have sufficient, I think the issue before us is there sufficient cause to open a complaint concerning Ms. Mignola? And I, for one, based on the summary that Ms. Pope provided, I think that there is. What do other leaders, what do other committee members?
Mr. Chairman, I would agree.
Go ahead and make a motion.
I would make a motion that we go ahead and open up a complaint against Ms. Mel Dallo under the circumstances of potential violation of ARS 3220912M and DD regarding unprofessional conduct using fraud, misrepresentation, or deception to obtain or attempt to obtain a behavior analysis license, and DD is violating an ethical standard adopted by the board. I also would add in there the ARS 3220912A and B, 1 and C. A is that it is a Class II misdemeanor for a person who is not licensed for the article to engage in the practice of behavior analysis. B, it is a Class II misdemeanor for any person to secure a license to practice pursuant to this article by fraud or deceit. And C is a Class II misdemeanor for a person who is not licensed pursuant to this article to use any combination of the words, initials, symbols that leads the public to believe that the person is licensed to practice behavior analysis in the state. C also, or I would also add in there, Rule 4, R4-26-413A, the board shall communicate with the licensee using the contact information provided to the board to ensure timely communication from the board. A licensee shall notify the board in writing within 30 days of any changes of name, mailing address, email address, or residential or business telephone number. And that concludes my motion.
Thank you. We have a motion. Can we have a second?
I'll second.
Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. Regarding this particular memo in the file I sent you, on the last page, page 28, it's a picture of the database showing her the license detail. This is the only place where it's really easy to see if there was ever a reinstatement date. And so going forward, I just wanted you to be aware that from now on, as I check supervisors' licenses, I will be checking this page in the database, and if there is a reinstatement date, I will add this page to the file and any other documents to demonstrate how long the person was not licensed and when, so that from now on we don't miss these. And in addition, I won't include it if there is no reinstatement. Would that be acceptable to the committee?
Sounds like a good plan to me.
I think that'd be very helpful, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a possible
All right, question? Next item item number 7, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding posting of a courtesy notice to the public concerning events attended by committee members. Ms. Perkonen, are you there?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to present the context for this agenda item. A recent event, I think, highlighted the fact that perhaps not all the members of this committee have had the full benefit of a comprehensive training with the relative to the Arizona Open Meeting Law. And so you're going to get a bit of a crash course into this particular area from me, and I welcome Ms. Galvin also augmenting what I'm bringing to you. Dr. Davis Wilson realized recently that I think it was a meeting or a continuing education event being held in Scottsdale, that the potential existed for a number of the members of this committee, perhaps even a quorum, might be in attendance altogether. And so she notified us with the realization that ARS 38431, subsection 4, defines a meeting as a gathering of a quorum of a public body at which members discuss, propose, or take legal action, including any deliberations by a quorum with respect to that action. So this statute, out of an abundance of caution, we want to avoid any perception or impropriety or perceived impropriety when a gathering of members of a public body occurs. It's very reasonable to expect or anticipate that members of the same profession are going to find themselves in the same place at the same time. And so the way that public bodies, including this board, like to address that situation is to provide or to post what we call a courtesy notice. We do that on our website. It's much like the process of posting a notice about a formal meeting, but what the courtesy notice announces is that members of a public body are attending a specific event, and we explain that a quorum may be present, but we assure the public in the notice that there is no business that will be discussed and no legal action proposed or taken. So in the future, if this situation presents and one or more of you anticipate it's going to happen or realize that it's happening, we ask that you notify board staff as soon as possible so we can post the courtesy notice, and in doing so, we're following a best practice and legal advice. Ms. Galvin, do you have anything to add?
I don't have anything to add, and except that if you anticipate or think that it's possible, then let us know. But if a quorum of you or more show up at a meeting, it wasn't anticipated, you didn't foresee it, then don't worry about it or stress about it. But just if you know that there's a large conference or something in town where most of you will be attending, then let us know.
That's a good reminder. Thank you. Any
questions?
Yes.
In regard to in town, there are some our national conferences that there's a likelihood that some or all of us might be there, at least enough for a quorum. Would that need to be reported, or does it just need to be within the state?
I would just worry about those that are within the states, where
okay.
your
Thank
jurisdiction
you.
Is, you know, relevant.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Any
other
questions?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Our next item, number 8, discussion consideration possible action regarding continuation of the Arizona Board of Psychologists examiners and proposed legislation including but not limited to HB 2184, FB 1054, HB 2224, HB 2288, FB 1142, FB 1212, and FB 1274. Ms. Hertz-Pacone?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So this agenda item is a it's going to be sort of a standing agenda item if it pleases the committee throughout the duration of the legislative session. One of my roles in serving the board and this committee is to keep you apprised of proposed legislation and its possible impact on the agency and the professions that you regulate. And so what you're looking at is the very first report of this nature that I've generated. I'm sort of thinking that this is going to be a weekly exercise. Well, I will generate this report on Fridays, perhaps post it for to the portal for anyone who wants to also keep close tabs on proposed legislation. But I did want to follow up to the request from the last meeting where this be where I brief you in terms of really the key legislation that we're tracking that most impacts this board and this committee. They include Senate Bill 1054, which is the continuation bill, And so the report that you're looking at is a little dated. It does indicate some movement of that bill. Since this has been generated, the bill has passed through the full Senate and has been transmitted to the House, to the second chamber, where it will be heard in much the same fashion. There will be a delay. It will be several weeks before the House starts hearing that bill. So we are just sort of in a waiting period with respect to the continuation bill. Are there any questions about that bill?
I have one. Does the bill also address the continuation of the Behavior Analysis Committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great question. So really what the bill does is it continues the entire agency. So it really isn't specific to, you know, only a component of the Board of Psychologists Examiners. It impacts and continues the entire agency.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, and all of the statutes under the board's authority.
Okay.
So in terms of House Bill 2224, that is the second bill that we are most closely tracking. It has three components. The component that, of course, is most of most interest to this committee would be the changes that you requested to the supervision requirements for BA licensure. But just to quickly highlight the other two components, the fingerprinting requirement, I guess that's also of keen interest. Fingerprint clearance card requirement for initial licensure, temporary licensure, and starting January 1, 2021, renewal of licensure. That bill has been heard. I'm sorry, the third component is also the opening the door, if you will, for the students of the former Argosy psychology program. They will be permitted for a period of time to essentially apply because of suspension of two requirements that currently preclude them from qualifying for licensure. So that bill has been heard by the House Health Committee and also the Rules Committee. The members of the House Committee, I think, had some thoughtful questions about the language specific to BA supervision, but they seemed quite satisfied with the answers, and so, you know, I took away they didn't have any concerns about the requested changes. The bill did pass unanimously through the House Committee. It has since been approved by the Rules Committee, and I expect any day now the full House will hear the bill and vote on it. I don't expect a unanimous vote. I think there will be members of the House who, just by virtue of their stance on occupational and professional regulation, may vote no, but I still expect the bill to pass, and soon it will be presented on the Senate side. So any questions about that bill?
Yes. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Bachman, my only question, I know that there was a little bit of an addendum that was needed. Was the language still taken over from the work that we had done last fall as far as taking out the categories of supervision so that we can address those issues in rule? Because I think that was one of the concerns that we had, and I just want to make sure that since there was a little hiccup in the transition, that I'm still clear on what BA language around supervision went through.
Yes, so Mr. Chairman, Dr. Davis-Wilson, thank you for explaining sort of the hiccup, if you will. The language had been provided to Legislative Council staff, and we waited patiently while they were drafting the bill. They forwarded over the fingerprint language, the changes to the fingerprint additional requirement, that the addition to the statutes, and that all looked fine and good, and we were waiting for the language that changed the BA supervision requirements. And when it didn't, it wasn't forwarded, I followed up and learned that they had simply forgot to draft it in. So it did need to be amended into the bill. The amendment was accomplished at the committee hearing, which is far preferable than trying to get it amended on the floor before the full House. So the language is entirely a reflection of what you had asked originally. So fortunately, we discovered the problem when we did and averted disaster in the process. What I will comment on is that given a recent executive order issued by the governor, which, as we know, there are some restrictions in terms of rule promulgating. There are some new restrictions in place that will make rule changes even more challenging for us going forward. And just to illustrate that, what that means is for every regulation change, we need to identify three regulations to eliminate. So changing the statute is half of the battle, but the rule changes, I think, will you know, we'll have to proceed through that and navigate through that very thoughtfully.
You know, Ms. Pagman, oh, sorry, Mr. Chair, I just keep chiming in. Go right ahead, Mr. Chair, sorry.
I was just going to follow up. Is it possible that some generic language could be put into the statute such that the issue of writing rules about this particular thing may not affect it? In other words, you know, we want to adopt the supervision requirements, in other words, and the DACD, effective 1/1/2022. However, we don't want those same rules to apply to people who were board certified prior to that, right? So that we have, so is it possible to work with the lobbyists and those who are drafting this legislation, so that we don't find ourselves in a bind where we can't write rules and we've got a statute that on its surface might be extremely limited to do it.
I'm probably
going to talk about, may I take that one?
Please.
Okay. So just to bring everybody up, keeping in mind that Ms. Pagnon was not here at the time that we did our last round of legislative work. So just to remind the committee where we were and then going into the legislative session. So going into November where we were. We did two things. One was that we requested for the statute specific to supervision to pull out the specifics of supervised experience, practicum experience, and intensive practicum, because we already were forecasting that the BACB was doing away with that. And so we had drafted generic language that would allow for us to define supervision in rule if we so chose to, but that we wouldn't have to define it in statute like it's defined now. You recall, because it's defined that way in statute, we weren't able to proactively change the rule to match the language that the BACB has moved forward with what they're going to call those supervision programs. Now, simultaneously, we still had a rule docket open that we were working on as well, and we were working on addressing the exact concerns, Dr. Davidson, that you're referring to regarding all of the new supervisory changes that we were concerned would get kind of muddied for those applicants. And so a lot of that rule, a lot of the development of those rules, if you guys recall, and probably somewhere in the file because we had done all this work ahead of time, a lot of that would already allow for us to bring people along, either those that were certified under the old standards or those that are certified under the new standards. We've already kind of crafted most of the language to address all of that. That language has been slow crafting, so we worked on it for, I think, almost 2 years. We finally got it approved, but it's not in place yet because they had to, because of the time that it took to get the language where we wanted it, they had to refile a request to work on the rules. So all of the work that we did last year in this area to address all of this is still work that's pending. And I think that that's kind of that mystery piece of that we've already worked on as far as making sure that the language around degree types is covered. So if you recall, we decided to pull that language, make it more generic, and say, hey, if the BACB approved your education program, then we're going to approve your education program. And so we've already drafted and done all of that work. It just hasn't worked its way through the entire process. Now, there is one area, I believe, continuing education is the one area that I think is a rule we will eventually have to look at. We also will have to look at how the rules currently are proposed to still define supervised experience and all of that stuff. But in talking with Ms. Papanon, you know, what the BACB has done is they've rebucketed what they call things. And so rather than having three experience types, they now have two. Rather than having seven CEU categories, they now have two. And so we're actually kind of confident that when that time comes, once the statute's done and we can now say, hey, okay, we need to now do rules for changing some of that other language that we weren't able to do this last year, we're kind of confident that the nature of the direction the language has gone kind of already reduces statutory or rule requirements. So I think I know that for me, like, I had to sit back and go back and look at all of the work we did last year. But to your point, Dr. Davidson, all of those things are things that we have already addressed, and they're just pending getting through the process.
Thank you. That gives me great comfort.
Mr. Chairman, I thought Dr. Davis Wilson did an extraordinary job of summarizing what I was struggling to understand, and assemble what was a very scattered puzzle, pieces of a puzzle that I was struggling to assemble. So she did, I think, a terrific job of going through all that history and assuring me that everything was going to come into place. But what we may find is there could be a period of time where the statute says one thing and the rules don't reflect the same. And that's okay because statutes always prevail. It's a little bit of a challenge on our part, particularly board staff will be questioned at times, why does this, I'm reading in one place, it requires this, or it says this, and in another place, it's entirely different. So we're going to find ourselves explaining that. And I should say that one of the hurdles that we need to overcome, or one of the criteria, if you will, for moving forward with rule changes is, do we need a rule change in order to conform with what the statute says? So I'm not saying that it's impossible for us to promulgate new rules. Dr. Davis Wilson has, of course, described that as a lengthy process. That is entirely true. It just may be a period of time before the rules catch up to the statutes.
Okay. And for our pending rules that we worked on, the governor's executive order should not restrict that work from going forward?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's a great question. We received the approval from the governor's office to move that rule package forward a few days before the executive order, the most recent executive order, was issued. So the rules that are now moving through the process, they've been filed in the Arizona Administrative Register. We have a oral proceeding scheduled for those rules on March 17th, so we're in the public comment period. Those rules are moving forward with fewer restrictions and fewer hurdles than sort of the ones that we're talking about right now.
Excellent. I don't have any further questions about HB 2224. Does anybody else? Ms. Akina, and I'm sorry for butchering your name earlier. Is Pakenham the right way to pronounce it?
Mr. Chairman, it's Pakenham. I'll answer to anything that remotely sounds like my name, though. So no worries, Pakenham, okay. Please. Yes, thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions about any of the other bills. I highlighted the ones that I thought, you know, we may want to talk about, but, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, I want the committee to have the full benefit of everything that I'm tracking, the same information that I would provide to the board.
I appreciate that. I do have a couple of questions, and they may be quick. In HB 2184, this is, you know, person should be granted a professional license as a certificate from another jurisdiction, in the same discipline and at the same practice level. I could be jumping the gun, but I read briefly about and we're going to hear soon about the North Carolina licensure. And so I guess I'm just a little concerned about that if somebody from another state can only practice under the supervision of a psychologist, then to come here with the same practice, would that mean that's the same practice level here in Arizona? And if this is better answered in the next agenda item, I'm fine with that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. So I think you raise an interesting question. I was looking at this proposed, at this legislation more narrowly. What I see in this language is this relates back to universal recognition to that statute. I see this as a requirement for this board, other boards, to be very clear, very overt, promote, advertise, if you will, the opportunity to apply for licensure under universal recognition. I think that maybe I can't speak to the, you know, motivation of the bill sponsor, but this is to perhaps ensure that boards are not sort of burying universal recognition application opportunities on their website or failing to promote it. So the question that you raise, I think, is a bigger one, and I don't know that I have a full command of all the issues and the nuances to address it right now. You're right, it could be something that ties into other agenda discussions.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may take a stab at it, with the universal, the way that I interpret it is that, you know, because we've got the universal recognition and they're trying to clean up whatever language, I see it the same way that was just described. I think that for us, because we are still in this funky position of not having state licensure across all of the states, those individuals would still, regardless, so like people from California, people from, you know, whether North Carolina is going to be its own little thing that we need to talk about, but people from California who don't have licensure or from Wyoming who may not have licensure, I think they might. For those states that don't have licensure yet, they still can apply through the regular application process. Like, this doesn't replace their ability to do that. They just wouldn't be eligible under universal recognition, which, because so many of the states still only certify and not license, that's a reality of what we have right now for behavior analysts anyway.
Okay, thank you. I don't have any other questions about the legislation that you included in our handout. Any other questions from other committee members? I do think it would be very helpful for you to post your update on the portal, and we just need to remind ourselves to log in and check that out.
Mr. Chairman, this is Heidi. So Fridays are the most logical date to provide those updates. The legislature doesn't meet on Friday, so it's kind of an opportunity to catch up, you know, assess what developments occurred during the days leading up to that to that Friday that week. So I think I'll just send a weekly reminder that there's a new report on the portal, and you're welcome to look at it.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Okay. Moving on to item number 9, discussion, consideration, possible action concerning North Carolina behavior analyst licensure, independent practice restrictions in that state, and potential implications for behavior analyst applicants in Arizona. Dr. Davis Wilson.
Yes, so if you recall the last meeting, we had an applicant who came through from North Carolina, and I do some consulting work in North Carolina, which is why I kind of had in back my head an interesting perspective of their current licensing laws. And I mostly wanted to kind of leverage the knowledge of Ms. Galvin. So essentially, North Carolina is one of the only states, they are the only state with legislation that's written this way. The only other state that has some funky, super funky legislation for behavior analysts is New York. But in North Carolina, essentially behavior analysts are unable to practice independently at all. They're considered an ancillary service. They are they're actually not even supposed to be independently completing assessments. And by independently, I mean the psychologist has to be physically present. And so even if an individual is going through supervision and learning how to do assessments, like, it's still the psychologist that's responsible for those services. And they're, I guess the easiest way to describe the way that I understand the legislation is that a behavior analyst is like an RBT to a behavior analyst, like what we would see here in Arizona, is equivalent there to like a BCBA under a psychologist. So the BCBA is able to do direct care, they're able to help with a variety of like RBT type tasks, but they're unable to practice independently, and they have to be tied to a psychologist in psychology practice. So I guess for me, because the legislation is so muddy, I wasn't comfortable with the idea of just blanketly saying, well, North Carolina does not license behavior analysts, therefore we could move forward with reviewing the application. I wanted to explore further. I have no qualms with the application whatsoever. I wanted to explore further the implications of, it's not just that they're not a licensed state, but that they have very, very, very strict restrictions to practice, and what that means for individuals who then do come to Arizona to seek licensure, because they're not eligible for universal recognition, but they're all like, they're not able to practice without supervision, and so they are a state that requires licensed supervisors. It's just funky that the licensed supervisors are actually psychologists and not behavior analysts. So I wanted to bring this forth because I foresee it becoming an issue. It's an issue on the national front. I'm struggling with the interpretation of it. And so I think at a minimum, maybe hearing from Ms. Galvin, or also getting some sort of guidance from the AG's office of what we do with this information when their practice in that state is so restricted that it potentially limits, one, the experience that these individuals are even able to obtain toward becoming certified. That's one of the hot issues that the state is having to deal with, and behavior analysts are having to deal with.
And then two, how does that look when we're reviewing applications?
Do any of the other committee members have any questions of Ms. of Dr. Davis Wilson? No. I understand the issues that you have outlined, Dr. Davis Wilson. Do we know, is there anything pending in North Carolina that may change this status, or for the foreseeable future, this is how they intend to operate with behavior analysts?
Well, interestingly enough, there are, you know, I spoke with several individuals from North Carolina. Ironically, that the conference in Scottsdale had a lot of North Carolina people there. And, you know, I do some consultation work in North Carolina. And, well, I shouldn't say in North Carolina because that would be a problem, right? But I have clients in Utah that have practices in North Carolina. Let me clarify that. So my Utah clients have psychologists. I don't even know if they even have behavior analysts at this point because it's an additional administrative cost for many organizations. So they have psychologists practicing in North Carolina. So essentially what I have heard is that there's a, and we see this here in Arizona as well, where there's a big, like, yes, we can see how the law can be interpreted this way, but we're going to stretch it however far we can in our own interpretation. So it doesn't seem like there's a lot of clarity amongst the behavior analyst community. And it appears to be that there has been zero success at trying to get clarifying language. So the argument that the psychologists have is that it is clear in the statute, and they have it posted on their website, that it is very clear. I sent you guys what they have posted. But the behavior analysts are saying, well, that's not really how we interpret this. And so some behavior analysts are operating on their own accord, which is where I think the concern comes in of what we follow. But I do know that they have tried to pass bills to provide clarification. And they have been shot down. And I do know that the language, as far as what I've seen, is pretty clear that the behavior analyst should not be operating independently. That's up to them and their attorneys to sort out between each other. I'm not going to have that conversation with anybody. But no, they have been unsuccessful in trying to push any legislation that would alter or change or provide clarification to what it means. And as far as my understanding goes, the organizations are having to, when they credential with health plans, they're having to credential under the psychologist. So similar to the RBTs here with us, we can have RBTs billing under our MPI and RCAQH and all of that. That is how the health plans are paying on the service. So where I can understand the behavior analyst being interested in like saying, well, we can read the law whatever way we want, the issue is still that the health plans are even reading the law the same way the psychology board is and are saying, no, we will not credential behavior analysts to practice independently.
So it appears that that's their current system, and there's nothing on the radar to indicate that they're going to deviate from that. Have you heard from your peers
Correct.
In other states how they're handling this?
Well, no, because the variations in licensure in other states are so drastic that, you know, you take Kentucky, Connecticut, all these individuals have to do is just show that they have a BACB certificate. So they're not having to have their supervision verified in many of the states. And so many of the states it's a non-issue because so long as the BACB issues you a certificate and you are a BCBA in good standing, and, you know, Nevada and a couple of other states have, like, you know, their tests on just the regulations itself. But no, many of the states don't have the same language as us in the supervision piece that would restrict someone from North Carolina to going over. Now, Kentucky does have in there that that you do have to have a licensed supervisor if you are in the state of Kentucky getting services, and also if their language around licensed supervisor is very similar to ours. But I don't think that they have seen, and I've talked to a couple of my peers in Kentucky, and I don't think they've seen a lot of individuals from North Carolina relocate. So this was, and like I said, last application was our first one too, and I didn't really think of the implications of what this may mean. But at this point, no. Unfortunately, the behavior analyst community is not as well versed in regulatory functions as I think that we probably should be.
Mr. Chairman, this is Heidi. A little bit of a spoiler alert here. Earlier this week, I was invited by the chair of the Association of Professional Behavior Analysts. I believe I'm identifying her role correctly. At any rate, the annual convention of the APBA will be held next month in Denver. And in conjunction with that, with the larger meeting, with the event, they host a short meeting for regulators or representatives of regulatory boards of behavior analysts. So I'll be asking the board to send me to this meeting, and I would love to go to this meeting if I'm approved, armed with as much information as I can be to understand this issue, other regulatory issues, cross-jurisdictional regulatory issues. So I think that might be an opportunity to learn maybe fill in our gaps of understanding on some level.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Peckman, I also will be at Denver. I didn't even think of it from that perspective, but yes, there's also going to be several workshops, and I'll be doing a panel presentation with some other individuals interested in the world of regulating behavior analysts. Yes, that would be, I think, great for you to be at, and I would be happy to obviously support that as a full board, but also introduce you to people while we're out there, because I will, like I said, I will already be out there as well.
Excellent.
I agree. I think it's a great opportunity. I'm glad you're going to be there, and I'm glad that Dr. James Wilson will also be there. Let the rest of us know if and how we can help bring you up to speed if that's necessary, or answer questions that you might have.
And then after that meeting, I'll huddle with Dr. Davis Wilson and Heidi, and we'll get back to the committee after that.
Great, thank you. So any further discussion on North Carolina agenda item 9? Okay. Thank you for that update and the background and the implications for us. Item number 10, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding reactivation request from Carolyn Simonsek. Dr. Ray?
Mr. Chair, yes, I apologize. I am recused from this matter.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Carolyn had voluntarily
placed her license on inactive status and then reached out to the board to indicate that she would like to reactivate her license. It was earlier, but she did submit all of her continuing ed for that period. In reviewing what was submitted, she did meet the requirements, and so I would recommend that we move this forward for reactivation.
Thank you. Questions of other committee members? Any concerns? Hearing none. Do we need a motion?
Yes, please.
So I would motion that we move Carolyn Zemechik, sorry about that, application for reinstatement forward for board approval.
And I'll second that.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Item number 11, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding additional information provided in new BACB online registry results. Ms. Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Many of you may have noticed that the BACB launched a new enhanced BACB certificate registry on January 10th. It has a number of enhancements, including being able to filter by certification type. However, in using it for this, the applicants for this board meeting, I noticed that even when I filtered out RBT and BCABA results, they still showed up in the final applicants or licensees results, online registry results. You can see I put a picture in the memo of Christina Faust, who was one of our applicants that you recommended approval for today. I did not search for her RBT when I did the search, but it still showed it. So my question to the committee is, with these enhanced results, does the committee want to see all of the results if they happen to have RBT or BCABA certification as well as their BCBA certification? Or should I just remove the RBT or BCABA and show only what you actually need for the purpose of verifying that the applicant has passed the exam and supervisors are BCBA certified and met the BACB supervision training requirements? And that concludes my request.
Thank you. Is there any easier or harder for you either way?
It's the same either way. My process in giving this information to you, I actually, because of the font color that the BACB has used, it tends to be very light and it doesn't print well. And so I copy that data and paste it into a Word document and then change the font color to black so that it's easy to scan and read. And so it's the same either way, because I'm just copying and pasting and dropping it into a different document and then printing it. So
what we're looking at in your memo is a Word document. I'm looking at page 202 specifically at Christina. And it comes across on my screen as sort of a very light feel. Was that modified by you, or was that a picture straight from
them? That's actually straight from the registry. They highlight the certification level, and so I have not tried to remove that. I leave that in.
Okay. I can see that as is. And I would personally just be looking at board certified behavior analysts and regional certification dates, expiration dates, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know about others.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, committee members, Ms. Fox, I think this is fine, and just to clarify, this was not manipulated at all in Word?
Correct. I actually took this as a snippet. I took a, basically it's a screenshot of this area of the registry.
Well, unless there's other objections, I would say don't waste your time making it, changing the font or darkening it. It's legible for me anyway, so I don't know. You need to worry about doing that.
Well, I do it because the printout ends up too many pages. I find that for being able to read it and keeping it onto one page, giving you the results that way seems to me to be more satisfactory in terms of keeping paper.
Well, I wouldn't want to remove that satisfaction from you. if that's better for you, then go for it.
It is. This is where I'm OCD is how things look.
Okay. Well, I'd like to keep it happy, so.
Yeah. Whatever works best for you. Legibility for me and can I find certification level and date and expiration date?
Okay, so there's no, Mr. Chairman, committee members, so there's no value in including any other certification level besides BCBA?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the only thing I could see might be valid is if we ever had a complaint against a BCBA for supervising an RBT and they weren't qualified to do so. But I mean, as far as the certification level of the individual, I would say, yeah, the board certified behavior analyst is adequate for that, I think.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stenhoff, the qualifications for supervision do show up on the supervisors. It shows up under that. If you look at Christina Faust, it has supervision, and she has not met any supervision requirements, so it has nothing there. But on the supervisors, it's going to show all of their information for what they're qualified for in terms of supervision.
I see. Okay.
So the box under the word supervision, and again, I'm looking at the teal box on page 2. The darker box that says certification level, registered behavior technician.
Right.
Is that defined?
Dr. Davidson. The what you're seeing there is under certification level, board certified behavior analyst is all the information related to her BCBA, including supervision, and if she has met the supervision requirements that the BACB has. It shows that she has not yet taken that training.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next level is certification level registered behavior technician, and all that information below that is about her RBT certification. When, you know, what the number was, when it, the status, the original certification date, her expiration date, and who her supervisor is. And so that's the part, that certification level, if it's an RBT or BCABA, that I was thinking you really didn't need to see that because it has no effect on what you're using this for. Because what the committee needs this for is to demonstrate that the applicant has passed the exam or the supervisor is certified and has their passed the supervision requirements and the date that they passed.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fox, I would agree that, I guess the only information we really need is related to their BCBA certification, so.
Okay.
Any further discussion? All right. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
The next item, number 12, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding committee recommendations to board on process and options concerning issuing cease and desist letters to BCBA supervisors practicing in Arizona without a license. Ms. Packinett, how do I think that?
Excellent. A plus. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So yes, we're bringing this agenda item to you for purposes of potentially crafting a set of recommendations to the board when Ms. Fowkes, in the course of working on application files, learns that a supervisor does not meet this committee and this board's requirements as you interpret supervision to mean and supervision requirements to mean, which is licensure in the state in which the supervisee is providing services. I think I got that right. I am getting a nod in the affirmative from our expert, Ms. Fowkes. So I've supplied you with the statutory language on unlicensed practice, and also the rule that addresses supervision, and I present this to you for your discussion, consideration, and possible proposed recommendations to the board. Does anyone have any questions about, and maybe I should back up, I shouldn't assume necessarily that cease and desist letters are something that this committee is familiar with, so maybe Ms. Galvin could enlighten us on what is a cease and desist letter and when one might be issued.
Yes, typically an agency will issue a cease and desist letter to an individual who is engaging in unlawful conduct within the state. Because that person is usually typically unlicensed, we don't have jurisdiction over them to, you know, censure them or suspend their license because they are unlicensed. So most agencies will rely on a cease and desist, send it out to the individual, informing them of the conduct that they are engaging in, the evidence that they have to demonstrate that they are engaging in that conduct, and essentially ordering them to cease and desist from continuing to engage in that conduct.
So who is this, I'm sorry, I had to check and see if I was on mute enough. Who would this relate to? What are some examples of who this would apply to for people with whom we do have jurisdiction, people within our state?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy. We have had a number of applicants. You don't always see this anymore because I filter it before you get it. But we've seen it in the past, and I see it pretty regularly, where we have someone who submits verification of supervision for an Arizona supervisee. They're located in Arizona, but the supervisor is located in one, for example, was Washington. I think we've had another, some are from states with licensure and some are from states without, but it's irrelevant where the supervisor is located. What matters is that the supervisee is being, if they're in Arizona, that they're being supervised by a BA who's licensed in Arizona. That's the law. That's in Rule R4-26-404.2, and it's also going to be in the new statute language that that Heidi told you about. So that would be one of the issues, and one of our applicants, Eric Samuel Harris, that you approved today, had come before this board about a year ago, and he was one of those that you had to either deny or ask him to withdraw because he did not have, he did not meet that requirement. His supervisor was not licensed in the state where supervision was taking place. And so he went and got more hours and then reapplied. And you approved him because his hours met requirements.
Thank you for that example. So if we do the application, if through the application process, we discover, so we discover that there is somebody who is supervising an applicant for licensure in Arizona, the supervisor, him or herself, is not licensed in Arizona, that would be one instance where we could potentially send them a cease and desist letter?
Yes, that's exactly it, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Are there any other instances that any staff or committee members could think of where a letter like this would be helpful?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, this is Kathy again. One thing I am thinking about is that the supervisee is actually practicing without a license in Arizona too, because their supervisor is not licensed, and that's one of the requirements. That's the exemption statute. That's because their supervisor is not licensed, they aren't exempt from licensure themselves.
So both supervisor and supervisee might receive the letter?
Potentially, yes.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I have two additional examples of what we have seen before this board and pertaining to local behavioralists. So not even, we've got the issue of individuals who might be in Alaska, they're licensed in Alaska, but supervising in Arizona. They're in California, which doesn't require licensure, but they're supervising in Arizona. There are companies who run entire supervision models without licensing any of their supervisors in the states in which they're providing. So to Ms. Folk's point, like, yeah, now we've got an issue of people receiving behavior analytic services without any regulatory body overseeing or potentially overseeing them, which is a huge public protection issue. But the issue is not just about remote supervision. We have turned away individuals who may be otherwise exempt from licensure for their practice who are then providing supervision. So we've had an individual who was exempt from practice because they worked full time at the school district, but on the side, they were doing supervision, which was not the duties outlined within their job description of the school, which required us to allow that applicant to withdraw their supervision. That applicant had to go get all of their 1,500 hours done again, and then came before us again, and we approved it because they got their hours done by a licensed professional. But we also, and I haven't been entirely quiet about this, and it's something that I think that Dr. Davey has brought up as well, is that we have our own, in-person ABA program, and students are going through unlicensed supervision there, which is hugely concerning to me. Today was like applicant number four, where they were a part of a program in which they were had a practicum arrangement, and the supervisors were not licensed. And that is extremely problematic. So I don't think it's just remote. I think it's something that's happening at the university level right now, and I think it's something that's happening with the confusion of that school role as well.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Dr. Davis-Wilson, I had forgotten about that under Dr. Haas has stopped verifying hours for just that reason, because he was unaware and not monitoring whether or not his students were being supervised by licensed BAs.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Folks, I appreciate the decision that the Dr. House took and the initiative that he took there. I still, on my own basis, I'm probably outside of a task of the committee or the board, I still have, you know, that program is still being advertised as kind of you get your experience and your education together. And I do think that there is some, I think taking the stance of I'm not going to sign off on this because I don't know is part one. But I think allowing students to go to sites in which there aren't licensed supervisors is still a problem that needs to be addressed. Again, not one that I don't know that we can address, but I think that if more people saw the significance of how dangerous this practicing without a license is to the consumers, I think that we would be in a better bet. And while I think that a cease and desist sounds scary, I think that that's the low. I mean, I have been screaming from the mountaintops for years about this problem. And it's clearly not making any difference, no matter how passionate I am about this issue. And so maybe they need to hear it from a different perspective. And, you know, when I'm speaking out and about, I'm not representing the committee or the board. And obviously, I have an interest in protecting the public just as my general lifestyle. But I think that at this point, we're kind of backed up against what other options are there but to do these cease and desist. And I also think that with the supervisees, it's just as meaningful because, one, I do think at this point it's the supervisee's responsibility to take some accountability for understanding the state statute. And two, the supervisees are the ones that are getting kind of the wrath from the supervisors of like, well, this is your responsibility and, you know, whatever. And I think they're both equally in positions of potentially getting or warranting a cease and desist. And I would be in support of that with the hope that this changes, with the hope that people start understanding that this isn't the way that it's supposed to be. And again, I think that it would be leading the way for what is going to become a national issue, because there's other states that, in my conversations with colleagues, there's other states running into this right now. We're not alone, Kentucky being one of them, where they're having applicants who are getting remotely supervised by unlicensed professionals. And so this is for me, a huge public protection issue.
Thank you for that. I have a question. What do we do after the cease and desist letter if we have evidence or complaint or obviously complaint even following the investigation? But
for those,
is there a just answer my question? If after a cease and desist letter we find out that someone has continued to practice as a behavior analyst.
For those who are in state under the scenarios that Dr. Davis Wilson provided, we could seek an injunction in Superior Court.
Okay. Would the injunction follow a complaint investigation, or would the complaint investigation?
When you issue the cease and desist, so you're asking whether you have to then open up a complaint. I don't think so. I think you could, if we have evidence that the conduct is continuing, then we could get an injunction in Superior Court.
So the cease and desist letter, in part, serves it as a warning that there may not be a complaint investigation. It may just go straight to an injunction.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, it's my understanding that we do not have jurisdiction over someone who is unlicensed. And so the procedure, I think, and Jean, I hope you could explain it better, the committee can recommend for the board to send a cease and desist letter. I don't know, this is where I'm not sure, do they have to open a complaint first in order to do that?
No.
Okay. So we wouldn't have a complaint procedure since they are unlicensed and there is no jurisdiction for this board or this committee to open a complaint against that individual, and that is why the process is, it's a class two misdemeanor. And so it goes, they get notified with the cease and desist letter that they're practicing without a license, that it's a class two misdemeanor, and if they don't cease and desist, then the board or the committee can recommend to the board to file an injunction with the superior court, is that what you said? I think that's how it would work.
For tracking purposes, you may want to open a complaint for mm-hmm. tracking.
That's true.
But procedurally, in my opinion, to go to superior court, it would not be necessary. But again, I would defer to staff who has to track that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is Heidi. I would be completely in favor of tracking because I think that data is very compelling, and I'm at a loss right now to think of a potential legislative solution to this issue, but that data could serve some purpose, or a similar purpose, or related purpose down the road.
And yet we can't open the complaint if the person is not within our jurisdiction, if they're not licensed or applying.
Yeah, it's a title violation.
We do. We open them on the Board of Psychology, the psychology side. We refer to them as title violators, individuals who practice psychology or hold themselves out as a psychologist without a license. And those have complaints and
are
tracked.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, that's moving. I also should have known that. Okay. So what action do we need to take?
I think they were just kind of notifying you that this is one tool that you can keep in mind when you come across individuals who may be practicing here in one form or another without a license, and this would be a remedy that would be available to you. I don't think you need to, there's a motion that you don't need to take, have a motion.
Okay. Are there other questions or comments on this?
Mr. Chairman, topic? Committee members, this is Kathy. One of the thoughts I had with procedures, you know, now when applications come in, and I've been doing this for about a year, if I get a, you know, I'm checking their license, I'm checking if they're BCBA certified, and when I have a supervisor that is not licensed in the, you know, where the supervisee is located, I've informed them of that fact and informed the applicant that those hours may not meet requirements, do they have any other hours, and a lot of times they just sit and they don't send me anything else in the application during administrative review times out, 240 days go by and then the application is closed and you never find out about it. So what I could do from now on is that when I come across those, take them, you know, and maybe even have a section on the application if it happens, you know, frequently, where I just give you those verifications and show you that they're not licensed so that you can then recommend a cease and desist.
Okay. How do committee members feel about that?
I like that course of action.
Yes, I agree.
Well, thank you. Is that going to impose additional hardship on you, or does it doesn't happen that way?
I think it's too important not to, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I think that it's critical that this gets addressed and that these supervisors realize the importance of licensure and what they're doing to their supervisees. I it's no hardship at all to me.
Excellent. Thank you. Any further discussion? All right. Item number 12. any new agenda items for future meetings. And our next meeting, by the way, is March 6th, Friday.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that, I guess it's just more of a comment, if I may. I would like to just thank the board staff for taking all of our feedback and recommendations and putting them in place, because I know when we've come up to this agenda item in the past, we have, you know, requested several tasks of them to kind of add to our future agendas. And I think, one, given the fact that Heidi just started, but two, on the back end, probably less of what the committee sees is that there's been a lot of moving pieces of what's going on that the board staff having to coordinate right now, a lot. and I'm so appreciative that we come to this agenda item and everybody is kind of quiet, because I think that goes to show that, like, all of the things we've been proactively trying to get in place, Ms. Fox and Ms. Poe and Ms. Pacman have just really taken over kind of the ownership of making sure that these meetings are so valuable. And so I appreciate that. I appreciate all of the due diligence that they're doing above and beyond to make sure that they understand the needs of the committee, to the point where, again, they're bringing stuff to our attention without us even having to, like, bring it up as an agenda item. So I just wanted to make that comment, because I think it's really important to have board staff that is able to be proactive with the needs of the committee, and it's much appreciated.
Hear, hear. Thank you for that, Dr. Davis Wilson, and thank you to the staff. I have no idea what all the work you need to do for the full board. Sometimes I forget that you have a full board and that you're not just supporting us. But it has been a fine oiled machine lately, so thank you. Okay. Any no agenda items for future meetings? Can we adjourn?
Thank you.
So moved.
Second. Okay. All in favor, say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Hello, everybody. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you.